Some 200,000 Americans in Oroville, California, and related areas are being evacuated from nearby dam, the Oroville Dam in California and its surrounding areas, ahead of emergency spillway failure at Oroville Dam. Oroville Dam on Sunday into today. Officials warned of imminent failure within 60 minutes at Oroville's dam emergency spillway at 4:45 p.m. Pacific Standard Time yesterday, according to reporting at KRCR-TV. There's also a flash flood warning at Oroville until 4:15 PST Monday. While the dam has not given way, the emergency spillway, which prevents the water from overflowing, was discovered to have a gigantic hole and was eroding. The structure fails, it will result in an uncontrolled release of floodwaters from Lake Oroville, the second largest reservoir in California. An emergency evacuation of Yuba City and Marysville were ordered late Sunday afternoon, and Gridley and Live Oak included in the evacuation alert on Sunday evening. Evacuation centers were filling up late last night. As of Sunday night, officials said the danger of total failure had dropped as the erosion was stopped, but evacuation was continuing. California Governor Jerry Brown issued a state of emergency order last Sunday evening in response to the dam's overflowing crisis. He says, quote, "I've been in close contact with emergency personnel managing the situation in Oroville throughout the weekend, and it's clear the circumstances are complex and rapidly changing. The state is directing all necessary personnel and resources to deal with a very serious situation." They did call in the state military. And in response to the situation, the California Department of Water Resources increased water release to 100,000 cubic feet per second. So it's a pretty amazing situation. If you haven't seen it on the news, there's a giant spillway that apparently was not really used that much, a giant concrete spillway, which as they were venting out a lot of this water, as the reservoir had reached maximum capacity at 3.5 million gallons. And as the water cascaded down, small hole developed. And as the water came down, it got bigger and bigger and bigger until finally there was a giant rupture between part of the concrete spillway and the other part below it. So it must have been 50 feet deep, 100 feet wide, 50 feet long. It was just massive. And so what happened then is the water began to divert away from the sides, and it started to take away part of the hillside. And so at that point, this concrete spillway is right next to the dam face. So it's just eroding support for the dam face on Oroville. And so then they began to use the emergency spillway, which is a lot larger, a lot wider. And as the water began to come over that, it was coursing down the side of the hill. The hill did not have cement on it. It was just dirt. And they had to go up and pull trees out of the way and stuff. So anyway, it was an ongoing situation. It looked last night or yesterday as if the entire dam was about to fail. So apparently, through some miracle, it has not failed yet. And as time goes by, it is likely that it is, or should I say, less likely to fail. And absolutely, just a fascinating situation and terrible. And there's many people that live below, and they said if Oroville Dam failed, Oroville, the city, would be under 100 feet of water almost instantaneously. So here's a little bit on that from, and this is from last night, Mark Finnan on KCRA News.
Well, and as Dirk and I have been mentioning, they did increase the outflows out of the main spillway, the broken spillway, up to 100,000. It had been around 50,000, 55. So they increased that, trying to draw the lake down. Now, Dirk and I were doing the math on how much was coming out of the auxiliary. Now, for a while, now keep in mind it's that concrete berm. For a while, it was about a foot and a half that was coming over there. Now it's down to about 6 inches. And at the current rate of the outflow, Dirk and I kind of did some quick math, and it's probably about another hour and a half to 2 hours that the lake will drop below the level of the auxiliary or the emergency spillway. So at another, by about 8 o'clock or so, we shouldn't see water coming over the auxiliary anymore. However, at that point, they'll most likely be able to get in and then inspect what's going on in there. Now, keep in mind, it's going to be a muddy mess on the dry side, if you will, of that. But then they'll be able to go in and inspect and to see just what sort of damage there may be. Now, it might end up being like a levee, and this is going to be the worst-case scenario I'll point out right now. If, let's say, there is a hole or an area that's been eroded on this side of the auxiliary spillway, it might act like a boil in a levee. So that's one of the things that they're going to have to watch. So even after the water stops coming over the top, which should be in about another 2 hours, there may be water seeping under. And I think that's going to be the big fear, because if that's the case, like I said, it would be just like a levee and that you'd see the erosion underneath the auxiliary spillway. I don't know how deep that concrete goes, but that is going to be probably the one thing they're going to look at even after the water starts coming over the top. So, but at least once the water starts coming up over the top, they'll be able to get in there and get some work done, not just from helicopters, but actually people on the ground. Also keep in mind that spillway, I know the pictures from the chopper don't give it really good perspective, but that thing is 1,700 feet long, and that's almost 6 football fields, if you will. So that's a long stretch. So any part along that 1,700-foot stretch could have some erosion to it, and that's what they've got to check. So even though the water may stop coming over the top in another couple of hours, I don't think we're going to be quite out of the woods just yet. So there's that perspective. I mean, from this perspective, it doesn't look like that's 1,700 feet long, but it is. And as Kelly was mentioning, that area in the top there, that's the parking lot. Now, in one of the press conferences we had earlier this week from DWR, that when they were talking about the need for that, they said that parking lot, which is a boat ramp parking lot, that would go underwater. And that's indeed the case. But because this has never been used, because the lake has never been this high, it went up to 902.5 or 902.6, and the top is 901. It's never been this high. So that area that you see in the upper corner there, the area that stretches up by the parking lot, water seeping through there, who knows what it was designed for? We're just not, it may not have been designed to have water come off of that, because as we've been documenting, the emergency spillway has never been used. The lake has never been this high. So.
And so there is some fury going on with some of the people that live below and others who had called out for this spillway area to be reinforced and for the side of that mountain to be, because, you know, like, as you can imagine, it's up on top of a hill, and Oroville is down below it, probably a mile or two below, that there was a call to fix it and reinforce it a few years ago, and then that was dismissed. Here is what a failure would mean downstream from again from KCRA News, and this is from last night as well.
First, as Dave was mentioning, we were seeing those pictures yesterday morning just as that spill began, and the difference is amazing. And while that is kind of unsettling, certainly, to see that amount of water come down, it is certainly time to be talking about the possibilities of downstream and who needs to be taking precautions. So here is the Feather River that comes down through Oroville. So we're really talking about the areas near Highway 70. So it would be all of this area between Highway 70 and Highway 99, including the town of Biggs, a relatively small town, but still you could be impacted by it as well. what we're looking at is a rise on the river of at least a few feet. Right now, the outflow, Dirk and I were just checking, the outflow out of Oroville is right around 100,000 CFS. Earlier in the day, it was around 60. So that is going to be seeing an increase here on the river. However, you got to keep in mind that 100 is still a manageable amount of water coming out. The channel capacity here is 210. Now, I know we can all get bogged down with CFS and what that means in terms of gallons or how much water, but just think about the raw number itself. If right now we're talking about 100 and the river itself can handle 210, you get the idea that 100 is still a manageable amount of water that can come down here, but we are going to see a rise. The fear is that if there is a failure of the emergency spillway, as we've been talking about and as DWR is fearing, then instead of 100, that number would go up sharply, and then that would be the fear. So that's why the evacuation orders have been issued. Again, 100,000 CFS is a very manageable amount, but if suddenly that spikes over 160, you're talking about a rapid rise on the river. And not only could that reach channel capacity, but even if it doesn't quite meet channel capacity, we could also see pressure put on the levees that we have not seen in years. Along the Feather River in 1997, when they had to release a lot of water in that flood event, we did see a flow come out of there of 160. And again, just keep in mind, channel capacity 210, they put out 160, a manageable amount. But even at that time in 97, the town of Oroville was evacuated just on a precaution because of the fear of a levee failure. And I think that may be part of the issue here as well, that a higher flow could put pressure on those levees all along the Feather River and all the way down toward the Gridley area. Now, I know a lot of you in the Sacramento area may also be concerned about this amount, but keep in mind that even if there is a much larger amount than 100,000 CFS coming down here, that before that would get to Sacramento, a lot of that would be diverted into the bypass at the Fremont Weir, which is above Sacramento, and then, of course, through the Sacramento Weir as well. So that's a bridge that we'll get to when something else happens. But for those of you in the area around Sacramento, West Sacramento.
All right, so it's 68 miles from Sacramento, and it would take hours to get down there. But Lake Oroville is the second largest reservoir in California, part of the water management system, 3.5 million gallons. And it's just extraordinary, too. And I have every couple of days, every week or so, I have, over the past couple of months, looked up how the reservoirs are doing. And you could kind of slowly see them going up while they were getting refilled by these storms. And really in the last month. And now suddenly you've got this incredible, it's really kind of an answer to prayer. But at the same time, I have to say that it is something that I couldn't even imagine that happened. I mean, a year ago, we're talking about more than half of the state in exceptional drought. And now the drought is going away, but funny enough, they've gotten so much water. One of the main water conduits, one of the main water reservoirs is on the brink of failure. And they were flying by helicopter in giant bags full of boulders to drop into this hole. And they sent the National Guard over there as well. So it's just really touch and go. It's a miracle. It will be a miracle if it doesn't fail, because all this stuff happening to the left of the face of the dam. Here is from Adele. Adele won the Song of the Year. This song on YouTube has 1.8 billion views, I believe, believe it or not. 620 Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces, AM 1450. Keep those folks in Oroville in your prayers, if you have any. We'll be right back. And hold on just a second here. We've got here we go. And this girl has an incredible voice.
Hello, it's me. I was wondering if after all these years you'd like to me to go over everything. They say the time's supposed to heal you, but I ain't done much healing.
And, you know, this Lake Shasta, which is 4.5 million gallons, is also to the top. They're actually over the historic norms, and they're getting to the top. I mean, what happened at this Oroville Lake was that reservoir, that the lake was so full that it literally, when you talk about the emergency spillway, it is an area on the lake that was cemented over so that if the water got to the very top of the lake, then it would begin to pour over on its own, and that's what happened. So in the spillway, the spillway that vents down to the Feather River is the one that got the hole in it. Here's a little bit more on this from last night from CBS Sacramento on what caused this emergency.
What's the latest? Well, joining us now live is Eric Fee. He's with the Department of Water Resources. And really, you're the man tonight with the plan who can explain it to us. We saw two helicopters going overhead just a short time ago. Tell us what's going on.
Well, we have had a problem with our spillway all week. Started back on Tuesday of this last week, and where a large erosion hole had formed on the primary spillway at Lake Orville. So we reduced flows, did an inspection, and decided we could go ahead and use the spillway, which we started doing. We're releasing water, though, at a lesser amount because we didn't want it to have – we knew we were going to have some erosion with by running water over the existing the resisting erosive hole. Right. And by increasing the flows, that might increase the erosion. So we had a measured flow that we were releasing over the spillway. And because we were releasing less water from Lake Orville than was coming into Lake Orville, the lake was increasing because we had – this is back – it was raining quite a bit. We had some wet storms come in. So the lake was filling.
Right.
So we were monitoring the existing erosion on the spillway. It seemed to have stabilized. And so we were comfortable with keeping the flow at that rate. In fact, our engineers, I know, were even talking about the possibility of increasing it. But then we decided, well, things are going okay, so maybe we should just keep it where it is right now. But in any event, the lake continued to rise through the week to a point where the lake was filled. It reached its full pool elevation.
Right.
And if the lake reaches that point, if it continues to rise, it starts flowing over what we call our emergency spillway, our auxiliary spillway, which is an auxiliary spillway over on the very right side of the whole structure of the Lake Orville.
And that's what started yesterday.
Yes. Right. I'm sorry. I've been here.
You don't know what day it is anymore.
You start
right.
to lose track of the dates. Yes. Okay. So water starts flowing over that the auxiliary spillway, and we knew when the water flows over the auxiliary spillway, eventually goes down and starts running down the hillside. That hillside is not lined with concrete or anything. This is just a kind of a woodland area, so in grass, and so it was eroding down the hillside, which we was expected. So it brought a lot of soil and sediment down into the waterway down below, but that was expected. Today, about 3 o'clock, one of our monitors — we have engineers that are all over the project right now monitoring, both spillways and a variety of other things. They noticed there was an erosion feature called a head cut that had formed and was actually in the proximity of the spillway structure itself. And so the concern with that is if the head cut moves upstream, erodes upstream, it could jeopardize the structure that the auxiliary spillway is built on. So and because this isn't something that you can really model, it happened very quickly.
Right.
They decided to notify the Butte County Sheriff of the situation, and that was the sheriff assessed the situation and the information that he was provided, and decided to issue the evacuation order to protect downstream residents.
Now, again, there's a plan you were talking about earlier at a news conference to now deal with this. So
yes.
More water was released to lower the level and the pressure of the lake.
All right, I've got one more little clip for you. Now imagine that you're looking at a map of California, and right where the above San Francisco, right where the state of Nevada takes that kind of that turn that goes from kind of a left angle straight up, which is where Tahoe is, and right near Reno. Across from that and up a little bit is Oroville. Now this is over the valley, this gigantic valley in California. So this is up in the hills in the Sierra Nevadas, and then you've got this massive valley below, and then you've got the different parts of the valley. San Joaquin Valley is towards LA, and then up above that is the Sacramento Valley, and this is up in the Sacramento Valley area. So probably the world's greatest agricultural valley. So here is how they plan to repair the hole in this thing now that they've gotten through the worst. But don't forget, there's supposed to be a couple more inches coming to this area of rain, and they've been on the receiving end of the Pineapple Express. This is a river of water that's up in the air, and it's coming from the direction of Hawaii, and it's brought an incredible amount of rain. 215 I can't remember what they had said. It seemed like it was 215 million gallons into Shasta, although anyway, I'll have to find that out for you, but some incredible. And remember at the around the time of Christmas, these reservoirs were all down, some of them 50-75%. It's been exceptional. Here's another story on how they're going to repair this hole.
Golston, there is a lot of activity here as these crews are racing to fill up big bags full of heavy boulders that they will later go out and fly onto the spillway. I'm sort of going to walk you through this here. These are the completed bags ready for the helicopters to come and pick them up and fly them as soon as it's feasible. They'll place them on top of the weakened area of the auxiliary spillway. There are several steps to this process. We've seen dump trucks coming in and bringing in the boulders, then dumping them off into the big rock pile in the middle. From there, the backhoes are picking them up and loading them into the bags. Then they're moved into that pile that you saw where everyone is just loading them up, waiting for the helicopters to get here. Right now, no helicopters are flying. I'm told that they are coming from around the state. They're being transported here to help out in the morning. And then I want to sort of show you off to the other side. Out here, this is the actual dam itself. Way off in the distance, you can see this lighted sort of walkway here.
All right, so when they were doing that last night, we'll take a little break here and come back and finish up. Well, that's pretty much it. Keep them in your prayers. There's 200,000 people that are displaced, and it's still possible that the dam could fail, although I think we've gotten through the worst. They're going to have to put hundreds of millions of dollars in this thing to fix it. 632, 633 on the button, and Las Cruces, AM 1450, 523, 1450. It's on the 13th. Tomorrow is Lupercalia, also known as St. Valentine's Day. Lupercalia was the ancient Roman version of it. We'll be right back.
Can you hear me? I'm in California dreaming about who we used to be when we were younger and free. I've forgotten how it felt before the world fell at our feet.
All right. So we had some record amounts of heat over the weekend. And now, speaking of weather, cloudy right now. It was raining all night. And today the high is going to be 51. The low is going to be 37 with a bit of snow and rain between here and El Paso. And then tomorrow will be 54. And they're thinking there's going to be some snow out with a big weather event coming through Texas. There's going to be a big weather event, so keep that in mind. And they're saying a heavy rain and a wintry mix will accompany a push of cool air across Texas early this week, just days after record heat. Pretty amazing, huh? All right, so let me get to some of your headlines for you. Sheriffs looking for clarity on deportation. What appears to be a sweep going through California, Los Angeles, Staten Island, and fear is striking the immigrant populations of various cities, including Houston. Mexican migrants signal they prefer detention over being sent back. More illegals are fleeing north. Canada is trying to take advantage of the situation. There is instruction from even teachers in the California and other school system telling kids what to say if they're illegal. Venezuela, one of the worst countries on the earth, is reportedly taking in a lot of requests for immigration. So pretty interesting situation. And there's a lot of fury out there. I mean, I think what we need to get ready for is a couple of years of fury. And can Trump make it all the way through this and come out on the other side and be reelected? It's possible. I mean, you know, if Obama was as failed as he was and he was reelected, I don't see why Trump couldn't be reelected. All right, so other stories for you. Fed's collecting record taxes. Donald Trump set to meet Trudeau, the Prime Minister of Canada. And Republicans are getting second thoughts in repealing Obamacare taxes because it's over $1 trillion in taxes. And salt of the earth, Republicans are becoming infuriated that they're waiting to do something about this. And I talked to my sister last night about the dam and everything, and she told me that there is a lot going on in terms of these people that want to drop out of the United States. And she says I guess these people are kind of sickening to her, and she's pretty liberal. So other stories, stuff is so hard to believe. The media coming after Trump still, speaking of the Grammys. And all right, let's take another break right here, and I will have some weather for you. Well, I told you the weather. I'm just looking at this map, which is called for a potent storm that is basically across the entirety of Arizona and the entirety of New Mexico and the entirety of Oklahoma City and Louisiana. And Arkansas, and then you've got the biggest hit is going to be over Texas from San Antonio over to Houston, all the way up to the Dallas-Fort Worth area under heavy rain, and then the snow is going to be covering New Mexico except for the very bottom portion, and a mix of snow and rain for almost the entire state, but it says we're supposed to get rain. We'll be right back.
There's
such a difference between
all right. So in some other news for you, let me just see here. From the Drudge Report, Black Lives Matter co-founder appears to label white people as defective. And other news, Saturday Night Live hitting Trump again and again and again with hints of exhaustion. Are they running out of steam? A young lady appeared on the Grammys in a Make America Great Again outfit. North Korea testing rockets, and their missiles are becoming more stable. Doctors preparing the world's heaviest woman for surgery. And in terms of the world's record in heat, well, what you've got is NOAA, which is the group that is given the responsibility of organizing all that stuff. They cheated and got caught on global warming, and there's no doubt that that happened. So, all right, so those are some of your headlines for you, and what else that you might find notable here. I do have a lot of stories for you. We'll take a break here and then come back and talk about some of the presidential orders. You wouldn't believe how few presidential orders that the president has actually signed. It's kind of hilarious with all of the stuff going on. We'll be right back at 646. Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces, AM 1450, 523, 1450. And... All right. So, you know, we've heard all of this fury and a concern over the executive orders of the president. He's made a big deal about the ones that he signed. So the question is, how many executive orders? And I'm trying to multitask here. How many executive orders has the president done? Obama did over 200. George W. Bush did over 300. You know how many the president has done? The president has done 8. Executive orders, and we do have a phone call here. Thanks for the call to the Kelly O'Connell Show. Who's this?
This is Michael. How are you doing, Kelly?
Good, Michael. How's it going?
Going okay, except I think everybody has missed the point with the executive orders.
All right, go ahead.
I think that today there is a protest that is being planned for tomorrow, but it doesn't have a name for what they're going to protest, but they intend to protest Trump tomorrow, and they intend to protest Trump Wednesday, and they intend to protest, you know, it doesn't matter what he does, there's going to be a protest. So hopefully we'll finally get over the fact that there are protesters.
Right.
Because they're going to protest every day for 4 years.
Right. So are they going to be covered every day?
What we're doing wrong is we're talking to these people logically, and there is no logic. They hate everything that Trump is, stands for, and does, no matter what it is. If he was giving out $10 bills on the corner, they'd be mad about it.
Yes. So what can the people in the middle and the right do in terms of supporting the president?
Ignore the protesters, except if the protesters get in the road, arrest them. But whatever you do, don't talk logically anymore. It doesn't do any good.
Right. Well, you would think that there had been hundreds of executive orders signed by Trump. I found it entertaining there was only 8 that were signed by him.
Yes, but you're going into that logic role when they were going to, the first thing that they started working on in November 2016, you know what it was?
What?
The impeachment papers.
Right.
And, you know, if you engage in these conversations, for the most part, the protesters have no idea why they're protesting, other than they hate Trump, and so they're protesting.
Right. All right, Michael, anything else?
No, that's it. Have a good day now.
Thanks, you too. All right, folks, good advice there. Don't pay too much attention to these people. I mean, if somebody had told me after all these protests that there was only 8 signed, I would have been, I mean, I'm laughing right now. I can't believe it. It is, well, let's see here. Well, anyway, I've got a few clips on. I'm looking for the end-all, be-all coverage of this. But here is a little bit on the latest 3 that he signed. He's only signed 8. I mean, if he signs thousands like FDR did, I mean, these people are going to be so burned up by their protesting. Here we go.
Executive order approved by the Department of Justice. Enforcing federal law with respect to the transnational criminal organization and prevent the international trafficking.
It's about the cartels. It's about the cartels. Task Force on Crime Reduction.
And public safety. Preventing violence against federal, state, tribal, and local law enforcement officials.
so and a one that was done. One that was done for to protect the police. Now here's breaking news, saying the president's saying a new executive order is coming soon on immigration. I'm hearing thunder out the window. So just to let you know.
Hello, everybody. Hi. Everything good?
Yeah.
Press conference good. I think it was great. Huh? Really good. Are you comfortable?
I can barely hear this, so let's just switch gears to this next clip. What's next for Trump's travel ban executive order? And this is from Fox.
Our legal experts, Robert Driscoll, former U.S. Deputy Assistant Attorney General, and Karen Tumlin, Legal Director for the National Immigration Law Center. Appreciate you both being here. Robert, start with you, sir. Do you agree with Mr. Dershowitz's advice there?
I think I do. I mean, I don't think there's any harm to a request for en banc and maybe getting a dissenting opinion or something that would lay out the administration's arguments. But I think they're going to two-track it, break the executive order up into smaller executive orders that are clearly within the Constitution, and just go forward while letting the Ninth Circuit litigation linger. And maybe going back down to Washington and having a full trial there. So I think that the two tracks make sense. And from what I understand, that's what the administration is going to do.
Karen, we've seen this sort of cherry picking, if you will, of courts and jurisdictions to fight the executive order in, whether it be Boston or whether it be Seattle. Big picture here, is there any part of this executive order, whether you agree or disagree with it, that you believe the president is within his right to do?
You know, so obviously my organization, the National Immigration Law Center, is challenging the executive order in court because we think, as written, it is unconstitutional and discriminatory. I do think what we can all agree on is that what we want to do is uphold our value of protecting the security of the United States while balancing that against constitutional rights.
But to that point, Karen, does the president of the United States, and for that matter, the executive branch, do they have the right to decide who can and who cannot come out of the United States if they're not U.S. citizens? Isn't that part of the executive branch's right?
So the executive branch, certainly through the Federal Immigration Agency, has authority over immigration policy, but they do hit up against the Constitution. And what we've seen with this executive order is the president has taken a bat, if you will, to immigration policy when what is required and what has been accepted traditionally is taking a fine-tooth comb.
A bat versus a fine-tooth comb. That's just sounds really ridiculous. This is from 2 days ago. So, in other words, Donald Trump is not allowed to change things radically because if he does so, then he's taking a bat to everything. All right. How many? I misspoke. Trump had 12 instead of 8, so he signed a few extra ones since that article came out. How many executive orders by George Washington? 8. John Adams, 1. Thomas Jefferson, 4. James Madison, 1. Getting up to William Henry Harrison, 0. But then he was not in office very long. And now getting up to more recent times, FDR, 3,522. Herbert Hoover, 9,068. Calvin Coolidge, 1,203. JFK, 214. Lyndon Johnson, 325. Richard Nixon, 346. Gerald Ford, 169. Jimmy Carter, 320. Ronald Reagan, 381. George H.W. Bush, 166. Bill Clinton, 364. George W. Bush, 291. Barack Obama, 276. Excuse me. Donald Trump, 12. Wow. Wait till he gets another 100 under his belt. Take you out here with some Adele. She won the Grammy Award last night and kind of got a trifecta on that. I think she got 5 Grammys. 1.8 billion views on this video. Incredible. We'll be back. It's raining outside. Be careful. Get that umbrella. We'll be back after break on the hour.
Hello, how are you? It's so typical of me to talk about myself. I'm sorry. I hope that you're well. Did you ever make it out of that town where nothing ever happened?
All right, so we've got some interesting stories. A United pilot removed from plane after bizarre rant about Donald Trump and her divorce. She got on the plane. She was not dressed as a pilot, but she dove into the statements. And it just goes to show you when someone is in the news, and especially when a person is being attacked repeatedly, like a Trump has been, that person can become in an unwell mind. That person can become very much so a lightning rod for criticism or even attack. I mean, we've just seen this type of thing before. So, very weird story. So, and here is a little bit of clip. And this is from Fortune magazine.
And I will fly the airplane. Don't worry, I'm going to let my co-pilot fly it. He's a man. Okay? Okay, if you don't feel safe, get off the airplane. But otherwise, we can go. Okay. This is all set up.
She's wearing a green shirt and a what looks like a military hat.
Okay, come on up. All right, so I purposely offended you. Did I offend you? Okay, so did I purposely offend you? I did. The answer is yes. So, but I didn't, okay? And this guy here.
A guy's getting off the plane because she attacked men.
Flight attendants, please disarm doors. Flight attendants, disarm doors. Crosscheck, standby for all call.
So anyway, the lady shows up dressed like a civilian, and it's on a United Airlines flight. The pilot was replaced before takeoff on Sunday after she went on a bizarre rant about Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton, and her divorce over the plane's intercom. The pilot, not identified, reportedly boarded the plane in everyday clothes, not her official uniform. She shows up dressed like a civilian and asks us to take a vote to see whether she should change into her uniform or fly as is, Pam O'Neill said, according to Reuters. O'Neill was a passenger on flight 455 from Texas from San Francisco. The pilot then used the plane's intercom to call both President Trump and Hillary Clinton a-holes, according to O'Neill. She started off by saying that she had not voted for either Trump or Clinton because they're a bunch of liars. It just really sort of went downhill from there and didn't make much sense. And the pilot reportedly announced she was going through a divorce and commented on an interracial couple in the first class section, saying, "Yay, unity." Shortly after, the pilot was removed from the flight and replaced by a different captain. It caused a two-hour delay. And so United, of course, unsurprisingly does not stand behind the comments of the pilot. Now, there was something. Well, let me get into. Oh, all right. So just throw this out to you. A friend of mine called me. This friend always, a female friend of mine from back east, always calls me at midnight, and I have just repeatedly, you know. Anyway, doesn't make any use. This person always calls at midnight for some strange reason. So I got this call last night. One of the things she asked me was if I thought Roe v. Wade would be overturned. And I said, well, it's possible. That was one of the promises by the president, is he was going to put in Supreme Court justices would do that. Now let's take a little break from some of the overwhelming political stuff going on right now. and come back and talk about that. But first, a little bit on Michael Flynn, who's the National Security Advisor, has apparently lied to the president about whether he talked to Russia before the election, and he got caught lying. And so it seems to me they're going to have to pull him out of office. But check this out.
To tell CBS News that the job of one of President Trump's top-ranking aides is in jeopardy. National Security Advisor Michael Flynn is in trouble for not telling the whole story about contacting Russia's government during the transition and embarrassing the vice president. The president faced a foreign policy test over the weekend while he and Japan's prime minister were in Florida. They both spoke out after North Korea launched a test missile in the Sea of Japan. Margaret Brennan is at the White House, where support for the National Security Advisor is hard to find. Margaret, good morning.
Good morning. Well, FBI investigators are probing National Security Advisor Michael Flynn's contacts with Russian officials to determine if he violated the law. And while questions swirl about his credibility, White House officials say he will still be by the president's side in meetings with key foreign leaders this week.
It's not for me to answer hypotheticals. It wouldn't be responsible. It's a sensitive matter. General Flynn has served his country admirably.
In a series of Sunday TV appearances, White House policy advisor Stephen Miller declined to defend President Trump's national security advisor, Michael Flynn.
I don't have any information, one way or another, to add anything to this conversation.
Flynn's job is in jeopardy following reports that he deceived officials, including the vice president, saying the status of U.S. sanctions didn't come up in conversations with the Russian ambassador. The president himself seemed caught off guard by the revelations on Friday.
I don't know about it. I haven't seen it. What report is that?
Flynn's contacts with Russia before the inauguration were intercepted by U.S. intelligence agencies, and officials are comparing those accounts with Flynn's claims that the calls were just standard diplomacy.
I talked to General Flynn about that conversation.
Vice President Mike Pence, who repeated Flynn's misleading account on Face the Nation last month, is particularly aggravated.
They did not discuss anything having to do with the United States' decision to expel diplomats or impose a censure against Russia.
White House officials are debating whether to keep Flynn on board. This unfolded as North Korea test-fired a ballistic missile late Saturday. In a statement to the press that night, Japan's prime minister called the launch absolutely intolerable. The president did not condemn North Korea, only reaffirmed his commitment to Japan.
The United States of America stands behind Japan, its great ally, 100%. Thank you.
Now, the president meets later today with Canada's prime minister, and the two leaders have been at odds over Mr. Trump's immigration ban, which is on hold due to questions about its legality. Now, we do know that White House may issue an executive order on Tuesday to try to avoid complicating that meeting, while it also considers taking that fight to court, Gail.
All right. Thank you very much, Margaret.
All right, so I don't see, I mean, if that story turns out to be true, I don't see how you keep that guy in that position. And I think it would be an opportunity to for Trump as a political decision to show people that that he's got standards and et cetera, and that, you know, he won't put up with stuff like that. Here's a was looking at Flynn last night, and I saw this weird story by General McCaffrey, that the guy that had done the war on drugs and everything, who's I think he left as a four-star general. He was one of the most highly ranked and decorated, including injuries, Purple Heart, etc., of any general. And he said that Flynn had made up some Twitter accounts, fake Twitter accounts, and put out fake news. And he said that he had thought it was demented, and he called for something to be done about it. So maybe this is a mental health issue for him. Anyway, here's the song that won the Grammy, Hello from Adele. Beautiful. Probably the most beautiful female voice I've heard in a long time. Kelly O'Connell, 523-1450 on AM Las Cruces. You're listening to KOBE. At 7:15, it's the 13th. It's not too late to go get a bunch of chocolate and poison your Valentine. Got some thunder and lightning outside. you should be forewarned about that. We'll be right back. And I'm going to come back and talk about the decision in Roe v. Wade versus Dred Scott just briefly, to just a little appetizer for you to think about these next few weeks and months as the Trump administration continues to roll on and pick up steam.
Hello, it's me. I was wondering if after all these years you'd like to me to go over everything. They say the time's supposed to heal you, but I ain't done much healing.
It's 7:20. It's the 13th, day before Valentine's Day, St. Valentine's Day. And so here is a, before we get into Dred Scott, Hillary Clinton is running again, according to Politico. If that doesn't alarm you, nothing will. You need to go get your health checked. February the 12th, 2017. Why does Matt Latimer say this? Hillary Clinton will run for president again. No inside information informs this prediction. No argument is advanced as to whether her run is a good or bad idea. Instead, it's just a statement of simple facts. And the facts are clear that the former Secretary of State is doing everything she needs to do to run for the White House one more time. If she finds a path to do so, she will take it, and I can prove it. And then he goes through the various aspects of his claims. And I know it's terrifying, folks. I know it's disgusting. It's sickening. But for those who say that she's too old and too sick, too mentally ill, too diseased, too demented, too demon-possessed, well, that may be true. But in 2020, Hillary Clinton will be 7 years younger than the incumbent seeking re-election. All right, so just go to Politico if you... make sure that you're, you know, make sure that you're not about to eat unless you're on a diet. Okay, so here is, I'm just want to go through this for you. I just want to and not going to take a ton of time, but may take a little bit of time. But let's first get into. Um, Dred Scott. Dred Scott is this very famous case in which the Supreme Court made a massive mistake that was later addressed by the Civil War and later amended or ended or cured by the 13th and 14th Amendment. And the 13th Amendment applies, 13th and 14th Amendment together apply the Bill of Rights to the states, not just federal, and also anti-discrimination. Here we go. Here is from the History Channel, Dred Scott case.
I'm a historian, and here are a few things you need to know to sound smart about the Dred Scott case. This is the story of a husband and a wife, two enslaved people who both filed for freedom in circuit court in St. Louis, Missouri in 1846 and set off an 11-year odyssey that culminated in 1857 in the most infamous decision of the U.S. Supreme Court. Dred Scott was held as a slave by a family that moved him first to Alabama and then to Missouri. And then he was sold to another man named John Emerson, who took him to Wisconsin Territory, present-day Minnesota, where he was held at Fort Snelling. There he met Harriet Robinson, who was the slave of an Indian agent. They married, they had two daughters, and then John Emerson owned both of them and their children, took them back to St. Louis. That's when, in 1846, Dred and Harriet Scott filed freedom suits in St. Louis Circuit Court. They knew that there was a doctrine in state courts called once free, always free. If you were an enslaved person held in free territory, like the Wisconsin Territory, then you should be freed even in a slave state like Missouri. That 11-year odyssey took them all the way up to the Supreme Court, the one that ruled against Dred Scott in 1857. The ruling had three main parts. First, it said that blacks did not have rights in federal courts as federal citizens. Second, it said that slave states no longer had to honor the once free, always free doctrine. And third, it said that Congress never should have prohibited slavery in the Wisconsin Territory in the first place or in any territories. It was a dramatic blow in the sectional crisis. It created a huge firestorm of controversy and ultimately is one of the leading causes of the coming of the Civil War. Even though the Scots lost their case in court, they actually won their freedom. The children of Scott's original owners, some of them in St. Louis, had become anti-slavery. They had helped fund the Scots' legal case for many years, and now in 1857, they stepped up and bought the family and then freed them. Dred Scott lived another year, but he lived as a free man. His wife and their two daughters lived the rest of their lives as free people. They are still descendants of the Scott family in America today. Despite the tragedy of the case and its infamous nature, there was a human triumph within it.
Young people in large numbers came out.
All right, so you could say that the Dred Scott case helped inspire the Civil War. It certainly didn't tamp down that one. And the head of the Supreme Court was obviously Roger B. Taney. He was racist. And so he didn't want to see slavery go away. So let me just ask you this, just throw this out there to you. What if the majority of people in the United States became convinced that fetuses were actually human beings with what do all human beings have? They have rights. Now, I could make an argument on here. I have kind of always avoided getting into certain topics like abortion, evolution, things like that, because I think they're so argued out. But I think you could make a pretty straightforward argument that fetuses are nothing but human since they're composed of 100% human flesh, and that the Supreme Court has stated that when they become viable, when they can live outside of reach the age, Roe v. Wade, when they reach the age that they can live outside of the womb, that they're viable and they become human, or they get human rights, I should say. And so there's the sense that by implication, I guess, Blackman's argument is that I guess they get a soul when they become viable. But you can make that argument that as soon as they're conceived, they get a soul. They just can't defend themselves until, you know, well, they can't defend themselves for several years. But anyway, you see my argument. It's not a tenuous argument. It just goes against the Roe v. Wade argument. Roe v. Wade argument, I think, is a pretty weak argument logically, intellectually. It's arbitrary. Now, to say people came to the conclusion of that, what would be the outcome, what would be the application. Now, here's the 13th Amendment. Dred Scott and the Civil War helped influence this 13th Amendment. Section 1, neither slavery nor involuntary servitude except as a punishment for crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction. And you might say, aha, no such thing as involuntary servitude anymore. Well, what do you think the people in orange jumpsuits are doing next to the highway? Section 2, Congress shall have the power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. Amendment 14, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. Extraordinarily important. Forced by the Civil War and the aftermath, the Jim Crow laws. Now, here's a little bit on a brief history of the 13th Amendment.
In this history short, we will be examining the impact of the 13th Amendment. On December the 6th, 1865, the 13th Amendment, abolishing slavery in the United States, became law. How did former slaves react to their newfound freedom? Across the South, many African-American couples immediately sought to renew their wedding vows. Although marriage was not at all uncommon under slavery, the laws in Southern states did not recognize these marriages as being legitimate. Others, who had not been allowed to marry before, also rushed to exchange vows. Many freedmen also set out to find relatives they had not seen in years. Families had often been separated by slave traders, and newspaper ads appeared across the South seeking out relatives who had been sold away into other counties or even states. When families could not be completely reunited, many adopted the children of close relatives as their own. Many African Americans also sought out new professions, hoping to escape being forced to work in the fields of their former owners. Large numbers of freedmen moved away from the predominantly white areas they had been enslaved in to areas with larger African-American populations. Others moved to test their newfound freedom, celebrating the fact that they could travel freely for the first time without papers from their former owners. This freedom to travel without permission was the first step and a long road toward legal equality for African Americans. In the Reconstruction era South, liberty to travel was the very symbol of freedom for many. "I must go," one South Carolina woman insisted. "If I stay here, I will never know I am free." Many freedmen dropped their slave nicknames and took on new names as a way of separating themselves from their former owners. Names such as Freeman and Washington were common. Some insisted on being called Mr. or Mrs. as a matter of respect. Still, the question remained, would this newfound freedom mean equal economic and political rights for African Americans? A freedman named Henry Adams put it this way, "If I cannot do like a white man, I am not free."
All right, so how about the 13th and 14th Amendment as applied to fetuses, unborn babies? I mean, you know, to call an unborn child a fetus is to take away its identity, really, isn't it? Kelly O'Connell, AM Los Cruces, AM 1450, 523-1450. We'll be right back and dig into how Roe v. Wade could be overturned. And this is based on a very late night question that a friend of mine threw at me last night. 7:32, 13th of February. We'll be right back to talk about overturning Roe v. Wade with the 13th and 14th Amendments.
Hello, can you hear me? I'm in California dreaming about who we used to be when we were younger and free. I've forgotten how it felt before the world fell at our feet.
All right, so 7:36, and if you think that the hysterics and fury went out during this travel pause, you ain't seen nothing yet. What would be the outcome, what would be the reaction if abortion were overturned or greatly limited? Or let's just say the states returned it to... or the Supremes returned it to state issue. Now, here's from Trump.
Says he's pro-life. Please ask him to name one specific thing he would do to protect the sanctity of human life. Can you?
Well, I think that what we're doing, and I think it's a very important element in what I've done, I've become pro-life. I was, in a meek fashion, pro-choice, but I've become pro-life. And the reason is I've seen... In my case, one specific situation, but numerous situations that have made me to go that way. I will protect it. And the biggest way you can protect it is through the Supreme Court and putting people on the court. I mean, actually, the biggest way you can protect it, I guess, is by electing me president.
All right. So you're going to get a judge who would overturn Roe v. Wade. That's the specific.
Well, overturn
thing that
or. Overturn. I'm going to put conservative judges on. I think one of the biggest things happening in terms of this election are, you know, it could be as many as five judges will be appointed over the next four and a half years. So we're talking about five judges.
Now, what do you favor? Here, this is interesting to me. There are people that are radically in favor of abortion as a female right. And the local newspaper man used to come on from the Sun News, Walt Rubel. Walt Rubel said he was in favor of it, and he said it was killing a human being. So I was a little bit shocked when he said that, but if you recall that a couple of years ago. There are people who grudgingly support it, and to me the fascinating group of people is those who say, I'm not only opposed to it, but I think it's murder, but... Where they say, I oppose it, but I think other people should have the right. It's a women's right. Or they say, I think it's even murder, but it's a woman's right. Now, here is a question. Could Roe v. Wade ever be overturned? Here's Wall Street. And we do, let me take a real quick phone call here. Thanks for the call. The Kelly O'Connor Show. Who's this?
Tony.
Hey, very briefly, I'm about to do another clip, but what's on your mind?
Well, I'm just on this Roe v. Wade and abortion issue is, my biggest question is, why is it when a woman is killed that is pregnant, the person who kills them is usually convicted of double homicide because there was a live body inside, yet abortion activists say the body, the baby, the fetus is in a human being?
There's contradictions. Contradictions in the law. Do you think it'll be overturned?
Possibly. I think it will be. Not fully, but I think late-term abortions will be gone completely.
Well, if you have an argument for late-term abortion, don't you think you have an argument for any abortion?
True. But again, it's going to come down to when the courts see the fetus, as you stated, as a human being.
The viability. But maybe they'll throw viability out of the window. I'm going to play a real quick clip, but thanks for the call. Good call. All right, folks, Tony there. And Tony sounded like he was speaking through a tunnel darkly there. Here's from Wall Street Journal. Could Roe v. Wade ever be overturned?
With the election of Donald Trump, anti-abortion Republicans are cheering and abortion rights Democrats are fretting over the possibility that Roe v. Wade, the landmark Supreme Court case legalizing abortion, could be overturned. But lost in the commotion is a simple fact. Reversing set law is a difficult thing to do, and even if it could be done, it won't be imminent. Here are the steps those hoping to overturn Roe v. Wade would need to go through. Assuming that Trump's choice to fill Justice Antonin Scalia's vacant chair was against abortion, that would still leave the court in the same place it was before Scalia's death, with five justices who have upheld the 1973 ruling. If Roe is to be overturned, it would be because one of the abortion rights judges has vacated their seat. Even then, justices can't just re-rule on Roe. They would need to hear a case that would call it into question. And getting to that point in the first place is no small feat. Major abortion decisions have typically come from lawsuits challenging restrictions on the procedure. Opponents of abortion would have to find a way to get a case heard in the courts that raises questions about the core holding of Roe v. Wade, that the 14th Amendment, through what is known as the Due Process Clause, protects a woman's right to an abortion. In any case, before the right to abortion ever gets to the Supreme Court and becomes one of the 1% of cases it hears, it would first have to go through the district courts and then the Court of Appeals. And that can take years. So in order for President-elect Trump to overturn Roe v. Wade, in 4 years, he would need an additional justice to vacate the bench, have the Senate confirm his nominee, and then have an abortion case make its way to the Supreme Court. It's possible, but a time crunch in one term. So what if Roe v. Wade is overturned?
If it ever were overturned, it would go back to the states.
Trump is right on this. The verdict wouldn't render abortion illegal across the board. It would just leave it up to the states to decide. Many states already have very restrictive laws on abortion,
like minimum waiting periods, late-term bans, and strong restrictions on abortion providers. Those states would likely continue or enhance their restrictions, or outlaw it altogether.
Couldn't the Supreme Court, in theory, make illegal all abortions? It would have to be seen, I think, although it's quite likely it would go back to the states. But kind of fascinating. I think you'd see extraordinary, it would be like nothing we've ever seen. It could start, you know, armed conflict, although these people who claim to be so in favor of killing babies are anti-gun, ironically. Now, here is a little break. 743 Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces, AM 1450, 523 1450 if you want to weigh in. And we'll be right back. It's the 13th of February.
Between us and a million miles. Hello from the other side. I must have torn it down to the
All right, so here is one last little clip on this issue. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who I think was the head of the ACLU or something, but here's a guy by the name of Tom Hartman who's pretty far left. He's got a DC show, and he's talking about the fact that this lady listens to his show and believes, as he does, that Roe v. Wade went too far. If Roe v. Wade went too far, can it be abolished? Check it out.
Did you see what Ruth Bader Ginsburg had to say? She's been listening to this show. I'm telling you, she or one of her, I mean, we're only three blocks away from the Supreme Court here. She or one of the people on her staff has got to have been listening to this show, because I've been saying this for years, and it's an uncomfortable thing to say as a progressive and a liberal and a Democrat and an advocate of women's rights, but I believe it's true. And that is, you know, as you know, I can't find anywhere in the Constitution where the Constitution gives the Supreme Court the right to strike down laws. In fact, if anything, I find the opposite. Article 3, Section 2, you can read it yourself. It says that the Supreme Court shall operate under regulated by Congress. Congress shall define how the Supreme Court operates and, you know, within what parameters they can operate. But the Supreme Court, since 1803 in the Marbury versus Madison case, has taken onto themselves the power to strike down laws made by Congress and signed by the president, and thus become the most powerful branch of government. And what I've been saying for some long time is that in Roe v. Wade, that the Supreme Court, by making that decision and making it in as detailed a fashion as they did, inventing the three trimesters wasn't invented. There actually are 9 months of pregnancy, but inventing these distinctions between the first, second, and third trimester of pregnancy and coming up with separate, basically, rules for each of these three trimesters within which states can make laws. And then basically you can't outlaw an abortion in the first trimester, and you can easily outlaw an abortion in the third trimester, and it's more difficult in the second trimester in the middle, and you got to, you know, all this kind of stuff. That by doing that, what I've been saying for years and years and years is that by doing that, the Supreme Court took that out of the hands of the legislature and stopped the debate that we were having in the United States in 1974 about that topic. I remember that time.
All right. So this is a criticism that you would hear from me on any particular day, is that there is this deformed, amputated approach to social issues that the Supreme Court is getting into. The Supreme Court's power has grown monstrously. And so issues like, he's exactly right, issues like abortion that should have been worked out on a state-by-state or in a local level is taken up by the Supreme Court, and then it's settled for all time. And then because it never worked through the society, there is as much opposition or more opposition to Roe v. Wade and abortion as there was in the beginning. Now, you're going to have the same issue with gay marriage and a lot of other things. So the Supreme Court should be settling cases and creating law within the context of tightly fought issues of law. They shouldn't take on broad elements of public policy and try to settle them for all time, because really they're setting up perpetual conflict. We'll take one last break here. Roe v. Wade could be turned over, but it would take a while. That's the conclusion I think would be realistic, and we'll be back and talk about a crazy thing that John McCain did. 523-1450-750 on AM Las Cruces, the 13th of February. If you don't have a sweetheart, don't feel bad. You don't have to waste a bunch of money and all that stupid romantic stuff. We'll be right back. All right, my sister alerted me to a story that I had not heard of. Oak Flat, John McCain fought for Native religious freedom, then sold sacred Oak Flat. According to this story, Senator John McCain, Republican, Arizona, intense criticism from Native activists for his role in orchestrating the sale of Oak Flat, an Apache holy site located in Arizona's Tonto National Forest, to foreign mining conglomerates Rio Tinto and BHP Billiton. In December 2014, McCain and Jeff Flake helped arrange that. Members of the San Carlos Apache Nation, known as Oak Flat, as Cheech Bildagotil, the site where they gather food and medicinal plants and host dances and healing ceremonies. The area was once part of the old San Carlos Reservation and functioned as a prisoner of war camp for the Apache during their decades-long struggle against the United States and Mexico. Not far from Oak Flat is a place called Apache Leap, where in 1870 Apache warriors plunged over a cliff to their deaths rather than surrender to the United States cavalry. Today contains the memory of Apache leaders like Geronimo Cochise and Mangus Coloradus, and the tribe believes it belongs to powerful Diyan or holy people. And they're trying to move this over to Rio Tinto. Rio Tinto is kind of an interesting company. It's based in South America, from what I recall, and it had some real problems down there. So John McCain screwing up again. Archaeologists think they found Pilgrim's original settlement in Plymouth, Massachusetts, and archaeologists have pinpointed what they think is the exact spot where the Pilgrims lived in the years after landing in the New World. Every American school child knows that Pilgrims landed in Plymouth in 1620, but exactly where has never been settled. Archaeologists from the University of Massachusetts Boston have told the Boston Globe they discovered what is believed to be a part of the original settlement based on the discovery of calf bones, musket ball ceramics, and brownish soil where a wooden post once stood. And they think that this is going to change our understanding. And, you know, the people that were on that boat were, you know, what church they were from? They were broadly Christian, but do you know what church they were from? From the Congregationalists. The Congregationalists were the first church to step aside from the Anglican Church, which was the National Church of England, and they wanted to challenge the national decision-making of the church, and so they created their Congregationalists. Congregationalists, obviously based on congregation, the authority for each church was found in itself, and then the church was run by the elders, which is similar to the Presbyterian model that arises later. But the idea of democracy in America is the result of the theological work done by the Congregationalists, and then applying that one person, one vote theory for the elders of the church to choose their own pastor and to make their own church decisions. And now, of course, the church has become very, very, very liberal, but it was founded by Brown, and so they were called the Brownists, B-R-O-W-N-E. So it's kind of fascinating how throughout the history of America and the West, important societal and political evolution first starts off in the church or comes out of someone who is a priest or a philosopher associated with the church using some concepts that they find in there, and then they become adapted. Another one of which is the concept of the covenant is rolled over into the social compact, John Locke's covenant theory becomes his contract theory, and then that's all based on the Constitution. Anyway, thanks for spending some time today. As always, really enjoyed it, and keep those people in your prayers in the flood or the potential catastrophic failure of the dam with 200,000 people relocated about 70 miles from Sacramento, which has over 1 million people in that area, if I'm not mistaken. And do you think that Roe v. Wade is going to be overturned? And if so, when and how? Would it be through an amendment, or would it be just the Supreme Court going back on their decision previously? If it was even very liberal members of the court realized they made a mistake, then it may be sooner than anybody would like to believe. Anyway, Kelly O'Connell, 759. AM Las Cruces, you're listening to KOBE. I'm delighted to spend time with you, and I hope you have a good day. Meet you back in 22 hours. Ciao.
Hello. Hello, how are you? It's so typical of me to talk about myself. I'm sorry. I hope.